Hi, this is Fabi Fav.
And this is Babelito.
And we are
Latinos Who Lunch,
the podcast where we talk about important things like so sad. Hello, hello, hello.
Good show, good show, good show.
How's it going, Babelito?
Well, I'm in my old hometown. I'm very happy. We've had the best food. I wish you were here to see all the wonders that I've seen today. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm trying to pretend that I'm not on a Zoom with you and a special guest. I said we get right to it. You want to introduce our special guest?
Let's do it. So today we are very excited to have Josie Lopez, Dr. Josie Lopez from the Albuquerque Art Museum. And she is the general curator. I'm the art curator of the museum. Josie, muchísimas gracias. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to see you both.
It's very exciting because, as you know, we're about to end the podcast. And one of the first episodes that we had really was about Frida Kahlo. And I think that, to a certain degree, put us a little bit on the map. People are like, what? There's this, like, two queer, like, Latinos talking shit about Frida. What's happening? What's going on? What is this? And I wanted to conclude by bringing a Latina, Latinx perspective. So when you approached me, I was like, this is como caído del cielo. It was perfect. So here we have Josie to talk a little bit about a recent exhibition. And we're also going to talk about Frida. We're going to maybe close the chapter or maybe begin a new dialogue, but now other people can pick it up. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to see you both. And, you know, really having our museum create kinds of programming where we're having Zoom presentations is a whole other world. So I'm just thrilled that we get to share a little bit of your, you know, amazing work and podcast over the years with our audiences too. So it's really awesome to have you guys.
This is really exciting. It is a little strange. It yeah. is a little strange. And before we begin, Fabi, I have to tell you about our food that we just had.
Okay, and I realized that in a recent episode, I talked a lot of shit about New Mexican food. And I'm paying for it because everybody's been in my inbox telling me, oh my gosh, well, you have to try this, have to try that. And I want to officially retract that statement and make it more specific and say some of the food that I've had. So I am excited to hear about your favorite food, Josie, and what you've been eating. I know you had some tacos today, so let's get into it because I really haven't eaten anything exciting in probably the last 6 months. So I live for these moments.
Well, you know, New Mexican food is its own thing, but there's a lot happening in the city. Today we went to the Sawmill Market.
Yes.
Which is right here by the museum. And, well, I'll let you tell about the tacos because you...
you know I love me some good New Mexican food. Or as Kirsten will call it, some wet food. you're nutting. There's a place in town that I'm obsessed with where they have gorditas estilo Juarez. And I think we talked about it in the podcast before. But really a good taco, like Tacos El Gordo Las Vegas. I mean, free advertising. I never had really in Albuquerque. But the city has changed a lot in the last couple of years. And we went to a place called Flora, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the cochinita pibil, girl. It was, you know, when a cochinita pibil is so good, it doesn't even need lime. That's how good it was. My mouth is watering, and I just had that taco. I had a taco de asada, uno de carnitas, y uno de cochinita pibil. But I know your favorite is el de mole, ¿verdad?
Ah, and they didn't have the mole today. But usually that's what I have.
Mm.
So Albuquerque is coming around. You can find great New Mexican food and great Mexican food. So I bet I can already see those emails that you got. What were people telling you?
You can't mess with because New Mexicans and our Chile. Come on.
I know. And I I do love green chile. Like, the green chile in New Mexico is... I was there during the festival one year, and the whole city smelled like it, and it was a magical experience. But I think it was just, like, going over time, and people telling me, like, this is the best place ever, right? And then I go, and I'm like, what? You know? But it's because... And it's also, I think, because we have friends that are, like, really great cooks that are from New Mexico. True. That cook for us at their house, you know? And so it's like, we can't compare it to, like, somebody's cook, La Judy's home cooking.
Hello, okay? La Judy's and La Maddie's.
But you know what I do love about New Mexico is, like, the different combinations of food. Like the Indian taco, for example,
yes,
is I think specific to parts of Texas and New Mexico. And then like Frito pie, come on, like God bless the USA, right?
Amen. Yeah. I yet to have a Frito pie since I moved back, at least for a little bit. Do you like Frito pies?
I grew up eating Frito pies, so I mean, who doesn't love a good Frito pie? But I, again, like, there's Frito pie and then there's Frito pie. You know, like, there's red, amazing red chili that's loaded with all kinds of other toppings and things. And then there's, like, what you get at the dime store and, you know, like, Santa Fe in the bag
and
or whatever.
7-Eleven. Yeah. I pies. Oh, so I'm going to ask you.
Okay.
What have you been eating? What did you eat today? Like, try to make us jealous, but I doubt you'll win this one.
What have I been eating today? Uh-huh. Girl, you know, I just told you I've been eating trash lately. I've been eating really boring because I've been really trying to just not go to the grocery store as often, and just like, it's this thing, especially... I don't know if y'all can relate as like a first generation, you know, Latino, like I don't like to waste food. Uh-huh. So my concoctions have been like making meals out of leftovers, you know, very semi homemade with Sandra Lee. If Sandra Lee was a paisa, you know what I mean?
Wow. So that's an alternative universe.
So instead of a Kwanzaa cake, I would be doing you know,
a Cinco de Mayo,
Rosca de Reyes, you know, out of Pillsbury dough or something. But anyway, so let me tell you about last night. So last night, my roommates went and got In-N-Out, because that's like, you know,
two
West
blocks
Coast
from
standard.
Your house. Yes,
and it's literally across the street from my house. The devil. And I'm like, I'm good. I think there's leftover fries from In-N-Out from like the day before still in the fridge, because one of my roommates went and got In-N-Out. So I decided that I was going to make like my own like cheese fries at the house.
Wow.
So I got old fries. Listen to this. If this doesn't sound enticing, I don't know what is. Okay. Old fries. And I put, I had some leftover vegan cheese in the fridge. I put the vegan cheese on top of it. I had some chopped up, green onions, that I had done a quick pickle with them just to like top on like my ramen and stuff. Uh-huh. So I sprinkled those on top, and then I made homemade escabeche, from, my Chicano Eats. Shout out to Chicano Eats cookbook, a couple weeks ago. So I still had some left. So I put that on top, like the carrot, the onion, the jalapeno. Mm. And then I had a leftover cilantro garlic chimichurri that I
made.
What? Uh-huh.
Is that from the Chicano Eats cookbook as well? Or
No, I just made it because I didn't want to waste all the cilantro in my in my fridge last week.
Oh my
okay.
God. Who's buying all this food?
Okay, this is the thing. One of my roommates has a Costco, you know, Sam's Club membership.
Ah, sí, sí,
and they buy cierto. Food in bulk. And I'm like, girl, what are we going to do with all this food? Anyway, but, you know, cilantro goes bad really fast. So I made that. So anyway, I didn't pour it on top. I put everything in the oven except for the chimichurri, right? And I heated it up. And then I made a beautiful... plate of cheese fries, like nacho fries, and then poured the chimichurri on top of it. It was delicious.
Okay. Mm, sounds good.
You, I think you're like really close to winning, but still, like those cochinita pibil tacos no. were too good. I mean, that sounds amazing. You really sold it, girl. You really sold it.
I try.
Okay, so let's get into it. Okay. So I feel like the relationship and the culture of Frida when we started the show back in 2016 versus today, it's completely changed. It's so different. A lot of things have happened. Mm. So I really want to get into what has happened to her legacy and everything, but not without knowing first a little bit about the show. A little bit about the show that it's right now on view at the Albuquerque Museum. But also we can get into our relationship with Frida, because I also feel that when we started the podcast, we had some ideas and some perspectives. And I know that also you've had your journey with Frida. I feel like every Latino has had like a journey with Frida Kahlo. So let's talk a little bit about that. But before, tell us a little bit about the exhibition.
So Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and Mexican Modernism is an exhibition that's been traveling now for some time. It was actually at several museums before it came here. But I think each museum sort of has the opportunity to think about the work and the exhibition and to tailor it to their specific venue. So it does feature, you know, many works that are by Frida, that are, you know, the self portraits that we're all.
Yeah, there's a lot of iconic ones.
Yeah, that we're very much used to. But there are also examples of work by, you know, the Tres Grandes, Orozco, Rivera, Siqueiros. And then, you know, interestingly to me, when we started digging into this material, is that it also created the opportunity to really think about not a Mexican modernism in such a singular and kind of simplistic way that most people, you know, look at the Tres Grandes, for example, and think about the Mexican mural movement. Like, there was the opportunity to look at other artists like Maria Izquierdo, like Tamayo. Mm. And, you know, so that's really, when I started thinking about this project, I was like, oh man, you know, it is going to be a Frida journey.
Aquí vamos.
Right. And, but once, you know, we really started doing the research around the materials and then the collection itself. The Gelmans collected a ton of artwork, and it wasn't all just Mexico, but their approach to collecting in Mexico was also one where not only were they interested in buying these artworks, but they wanted to really get to know and to promote, you know, the artists. And so that's another really interesting, you know, like, how did certain artists get promoted, right? You know, and so collectors kind of play that role in that sense. So I was sort of grappling with, you know, a lot of these ideas on various levels. You know, how do we approach this exhibition? And I don't want to say capitalize, but I'd be lying if I didn't say, like, right. You know, we're capitalizing on Frida in some way, because that's who everybody's going to come see.
Right.
But once they're in the door, how do we then tell this whole other larger
narrative
mm-hmm. about modernism in general?
And that's what was very interesting, Fabi. When we went in the exhibition, Josie was telling me that when they received this exhibition, it was Frida, Diego, y todos los demás. And to a certain degree, we were talking and I said, well, that's kind of like the mentality that we think of Diego and Frida in the 1930s, 40s or whatever, and then todos los demás. But one of the things that this exhibition is doing is kind of flipping it and thinking about how they are part of larger ideas about modern art, right? And it's very interesting to see Diego and Frida in relation with, again, Los Tres Grandes, with the three big Mexican muralists, with people like María Izquierdo, which I want to come back to, but she always gets erased from the picture, like many other women artists of that period. So to actually see that, to see that in the exhibition develop, it's actually very refreshing, because normally it's all about identity and Frida, when we forgot where she comes from, right? And that's sort of like this the relationship that, for example, I've had with Frida, which I learned about her as an extension to modernism. And then all of a sudden, after, as we talked about in the podcast, after the after la película de La Salma Esta, she exploded. And now, like, we had to think about her in terms of identity. And that's when, like, I started backing up and realizing some of the violences behind some of these ideas, you know?
Yeah, and even when we did our original Frida episode a long time ago, I remember that I just latched onto her biography, you know, right. Because I think that's what everybody latches onto because of the way that her story has been told. A lot of people relate to the trauma of her life or the trauma that's been exploited, right? And not just that historians or art curators or art historians have exploited, but Frida herself, in a sense, exploited, which I find so fascinating and funny sometimes. And I think Frida's kind of looked at as this person that kind of was at the right place at the right time, stumbled into the art world or was writing people's coattails. But then once you, specifically Diego, right? But then once you start to learn about how Frida really played with her identity and how conscious she was of it, it totally opened a whole new, all these new doors for me. And I started thinking of Frida very differently after we did that episode, right. Because I know a lot of friends in the art world that are like, you know, Frida, that's our feminist icon. Frida, that's our queer icon. Frida, that's our disabled icon. Frida, that's our Mexican,
todo.
Right? So
todo.
She stands for so much, right? And to have a different perspective or to call those people out, it like totally...
lo crucifican almost like a pull, uno.
Yes. Uh-huh. And they start calling us haters, which... is true, but we're also trying to tell the truth, and I mean, I don't know, the truth, that's a bad word. I don't think I should have said that, but like, we're just trying to come
be critical,
from another perspective, because I don't think we'll.
When was the first podcast? When did you guys do that?
5 years ago.
5 years ago.
Okay.
5 years ago.
So, like, even in that 5 years, I think there was really a shift in the conversation around Frida. Because one of the things that, you know, actually scared me when we started working on this exhibition is that I had done all this research on sort of the reception of Frida and the exhibitions around her. And there actually was a lot of critical press that was really talking about the way that, you know, she was basically practicing cultural appropriation, you know. And so our museum had to grapple with that in terms of thinking about our programming. Like, do we have, you know, parties where people come dressed up like Frida, you know, so like that was
shout out to the Denver Art Museum.
That was, you know,
shout out to multiple art museums.
Right, yeah. Right. So we had a lot of conversation about that in terms of, you know, maybe that's not exactly the road that we want to go down. And that's also why it led us more toward focusing on, you know, Frida's role within the context of Mexican modernism. And, but yeah, so we didn't do the Frida parties.
Thank God.
But, it was because of that more critical conversation.
Yes. And that's,
yeah. And
go ahead.
Sorry. I just want to get back to my personal relationship with Frida 5 years ago. I would say that as a Latinx artist making contemporary work that, like, you know, I'm kind of poking and prodding over here and over here and kind of trying to push the boundaries between like fine art and craft and, you know, just these different silly hierarchies within the art world that I'm a part of, I guess. I stayed away from Frida because I thought it was too easy. Like, yep. Oh yeah, look at me, like a Latinx artist making art about Frida, like it's very one note. And so, but then when I started to do more research on her, I said, oh my gosh, I need to do the opposite. I need to lean into this and really learn more about her. And it completely changed my perspective on her, the art world, Mexican art, and the way that I carry myself as an artist nowadays. I learned a lot from Frida as far as how I talk about my identity and even the way that I look when I present as an artist, right? Because everything that she did was so intentional.
Yeah, calculated.
And calculated. And so before this exhibition, you know, what was your relationship with Frida, Josie?
You know, my area is when I was doing my research on Mexico was really much more of like a 19th century Mexico. Was kind of what I was embedded in. And I did a lot of research and writing on a printmaker named Constantino Escalante. And so I really, you know, my thinking around Mexico was much more embedded in like a historical grounding. So for me, Frida was sort of, you know, an interesting figure that was part of this Mexican modernist movement, but a lot of my work deals with artists engaging their own political agency and like really defining how these political caricaturists actually had agency. Like they weren't just participating in the dialogue. They were shaping the dialogue. They were creating the dialogue.
And politics.
Mm. And some of them were even politicians, you know. So thinking about you know, the free press and newspapers in Mexico, like all of that was much more in my
radar.
So when it came to someone like Frida, I think I thought of her more as a little bit one-dimensional, you know, compared to some of the other work that I was doing that was very much about not just art, but also the history of Mexico. And, you know, thinking about this show, though, I think reminded me that a lot of the artists, including Frida, including Diego and the Tres Grandes, you know, they were responding in a moment to the Mexican Revolution. They were responding to what did it mean to be Mexican? Like, how do we engage with our own Mexican antiquity and not necessarily a European, you know, focused antiquity? What does indigeneity mean? Who are the people, right? Like this concept of the pueblo, what does that even mean?
Yes.
You know, and so all of that sort of started to take shape for me as I was really looking more closely at Frida, but not just her. I think that the difference was looking at the context of everything else that was going on around her. That made it, I was able to make those connections now in a way that I didn't before.
So with that in mind, what are the biggest critical inquiries you have in regards to Frida now? Because you talk about indigeneity, we're talking about modernism, we're talking about all these ideas. But to you as a curator, to you as a Chicana, you know, like cultural creator as well, what are some, like if you sit down, like in an episode of Latinos Who Lunch, like what are the conversations? What are the dialogues that we need to having surrounding about Frida? And I'm gonna preface this because yesterday we had a Zoom meeting, and you put it this way that it was even to me was like, oh wow, if right now a German descendant white lady will present herself covered in different indigenous costumes and posting selfies on Instagram, that will never happen.
I was going to say that. I'm like, if Frida lived today and did the same thing she did, she would have been canceled 2 years ago.
Oh my God. Like five years ago. Yes.
Especially the way that she dressed later in her life, right? With mixing and matching all the indigenous garb, right?
I was thinking of that famous picture which you all have, which she's holding the Olmec figurine, ¿verdad? As Simon. So she's like, okay, we're talking about the Olmecs, and then Tehuana from Oaxaca, probably Silver from Taxco. Like, there's all this like different approaches to indigeneity all collapse in this Huaytina, you know? So like, okay, so with that in mind, what are those inquiries that you want, where do you want to see the advancement of Frida's conversation? Because it's important to like have this conversation surrounding her legacy, you know?
Yeah, I think for me, I was particularly fascinated. I'm always fascinated in the conversations around not just race, but class. And
yes,
for me, thinking about the commodification of Frida was something that was not really embedded in this project. Like, it wasn't something that, you know, this exhibition really is invested in. It really is about her life and the work that she created. But in my own thinking, you know, I constantly have the question of, like, what would Frida have even wanted to be, you know, commodified in the way that she is? Like, right. We know that she was very self-aware. We know that she constructed and, you know, engaged with this whole process of creating the identity that she came to embody. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that she necessarily even imagined that, you know, her face would be on coffee mugs and bracelets.
I was about to say coffee makers. Yeah, I saw like one of those Nespresso machines
right.
with like caricatura de Frida.
Right. So, I mean, I guess I have this interesting, you know, play going on in my mind between what does an exhibition ultimately do? You know, what are the ideas that we're, what are the questions that we're raising? And to me, that was sort of not a question that was raised by the artwork or anything else, but just around the general sort of conversation that surrounds her. And I think, you know, in one of the reasons why the cultural appropriation, you know, argument keeps coming back and her problematic relationship with indigeneity, you know, keeps getting raised, but we don't necessarily talk about it in terms of class. And I'm curious right. about what is that, you know, how does that also inform, you know, the way that we think about her and the way that she's viewed now, as opposed to, you know, she was a communist. She was like having affairs with Trotsky. So I don't know that, you know, like it's interesting to try to square the cult of Frida with sort of the historical evidence that we know, you know, was part of her life.
And I think this whole idea about consumption goes into the problems of how to what degree we accept female artists. I always think about, for instance, how there was an exhibition of Frida in the Brooklyn Museum, and in a beautiful crystal cage, they had one of her lipsticks. And it's this idea that you cannot separate domesticity, consumption, and womanhood. And that's something that has been around since the 18th century. And I felt that she was the perfect marketable, welcome to exotic Mexico product that not only was useful for the government of Mexico, because, you know, like Mexico promotes a Frida fantasy to, you know, when you travel, but it also speaks about some of our own fantasies that we have about consuming Mexico.
Mm.
You know, the way that we consume Mexico, the way that we buy Mexico, the way that we display Mexico in our own homes and sometimes in our own bodies. Mm. And there's just like, there's so many themes, because we talk about this marketability of Mexicanidad that in a way was invented onto her as opposed to invented by her. But it works because you clash class, you clash indigeneity, you clash all these different things. And I think when it comes to class, we tend to, especially in the United States, we tend to think about race divorced from that. Mm-hmm. It's a very binary system. It's black and white. But when you think about the development of class and the distortion that is mestizaje, the distortion that is mestizaje, we always think it's European indigenous, just like in the United States, it's black and white. But in Mexico, in the colonial period, everything was embedded in class. There's this horrible, 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 terrible show in Netflix. It's called Made in Mexico. I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
It's like the 1% of Mexico City.
Oh.
So when we talk about the Creoles, Sor Juan Inés de la Cruz, Carlos Iguenzi Góngora in the 17th century, and then I play an episode of that show. And I tell them, this is Creole supremacy, and it still exists in Mexico, and it's still, and it's, yes, you have whiteness embedded in it, but there's also morenos, you know? So like, race, the color of your skin is just one aspect. It's all about class. And you're right. We, because in the States, we think about it in terms of color of skin more than anything.
Yeah.
We don't think about a class in Mexico. I think it has a lot to do with that.
Well, and I remember with you, actually, we've had several conversations, I think, around, you know, custa paintings.
Yeah.
And just how, you know, how that actually does have an impact on the way that we think about class. But even this, you know, we mentioned the Olmeca figurine, you know, yeah. Like it also gets me thinking about like ballet folklorico type stuff,
yes.
You know, and like how, as you know, how do we have to, how do we elevate the antiquity of Mexico? We focus on the Aztecs, right? And we have, you know, Aztec dances, and we have, you know, so there's, and sort of, but what about the indigenous people that are actually there now,
right?
And how do they get erased while at the same time you have this sort of elevation, you know, of a different kind of indigenous identity that's related to like empire, basically. And so, you know, so there's so many different levels, right, of like what that ultimately brings up. But, and I think that, you know, Frida did play on some of those things like that. And so did the other Mexican modernists that were in the exhibition. I mean, even looking at, you know, the mural movement in Mexico, when you see the, you know, the histories that are being told, you know, it's sort of this like concept of art for the people, but how was that right. The case, right? In different ways. So anyway, I think it's all fascinating to have kind of, but when you bring it to sort of a class context, it does add another layer to the conversation about her in general.
Yeah. And I mean, excuse me. I mean, you can see it in her artwork, right? When she was first painting herself back in the 20s, I mean, she looked like a flapper, like a modern woman, right? And then slowly but surely, because of the trends in popular media, in popular art, even, you know, just with, you know, the exploitation of this, of indigenous cultures as a national symbol, she latched onto it. She was an early adapter, as they say now.
Right.
And she, I mean, and then eventually she became the symbol for that, of, you know, and I don't know. I think that's like marketing genius on Frida's part, right? And Pablito, go ahead.
No, I think it's also, when I'm thinking of this transition of the flapper girl, like that iconic picture when she's like dressed like a man, you know, like, which I totally respect, and I think it's so badass. And this transition into like this more indigenous woman, I think about the perceptions of indigeneity. Indigeneity must remain in the past, right? Indigeneity must signify the past, and that's not what we see it doesn't signify progress. And that relates back to your discussion of 19th century, because in Mexico, Stacy Whittifield calls it the Indian predicament. Uphold the principles of the Aztec Empire, but downplay the presence of contemporary indigenous peoples. But more than a predicament, it's sort of embedded with ideas of class. That as long as you align yourself with power, you have to play those roles of discriminate against indigenous people, but also uphold ideas of the Aztec Empire. And it's really, really, really complicated. But at the core of it, contemporary indigenous presence signified, and to a certain degree still signifies to a lot of people in Mexico, backwardness. It signifies low class, and it signifies the past. Mm-hmm. How you view that, how do you access the past, and what do you think about the past? That's completely different. But that's exactly what we think about indigenous people. And that's everywhere. I think of Aboriginal peoples in Australia. Their art is everywhere. You see it in airplanes, in Qantas, and all this shit. But then when it comes to the way that that Aborigines people are treated in Australia, es un pinche desorden. Like, it's really, really problematic. But I think it's this, like, class relationship with the indigeneity that it does change almost in every decade, but those ideas remain stable, you know?
Well, and it's also part of, like, for Mexico, it's national identity too, right? Mm-hmm. That's absolutely being constructed, you know, and this connection to an indigenous antiquity, the ideas and concepts around even, you know, the church, right? The Guadalupe, having her, like, that's deeply embedded in, like, ultimately, what does it mean to be Mexican? You know, and that comes from, you know, an earlier time when you had the Scientificos who were really thinking about these different levels of, you know, how do we construct a Mexican national identity that is ultimately, you know, quintessentially Mexican. And so I think all of that, and it's interesting because then you see it play out, you know, after the revolution, it comes back in spades, right? And you see it playing out in the artwork, and you clearly see it in, you know, the mural movement, which, you know, we've talked about this a little bit, but, you know, which starts out as this what's considered a revolutionary art, but then really becomes a government sanctioned.
Yeah, it gets co-opted
project.
By the empire. Correct.
Right. So there's this whole, you know, all of that kind of at play. And so when you put Frida into that conversation, it broadens a whole understanding of sort of like, well, what's the history of Mexico? Because it really plays, you know, on that construction of identity.
Yeah, and the also the erasure of indigeneity that happens when Frida is the representative of indigeneity.
Yes,
because when it really boils down to it, and you look at the clothes that she chooses to wear, the costumes that she chooses to put on, pretty much all of it is like post-colonial indigenous garb influenced by the church. So it's like a way to reinforce the power of the church and colonialism in Mexico. And that's why that part, that kind of indigeneity is celebrated and rewarded, right?
Yeah, and I think also the way that indigeneity, it's conceived, as you said, like in the 19th century. And it's so interesting because I just wrote an article for coming June 2021 in the Art Bulletin.
Okay, published.
I'm so proud of that article. But one of the things I talk about in that article is that the científicos, because Porfirio Diaz had a group of creoles, really, of the intellects. And they're the ones who are trying to, you know, take Mexico back, basically, because from Alexander von Humboldt traveling to Mexico in the early 1800s, all the way to like Carnebel, Catherwood, like all these other artists arriving to Mexico and keeping indigenous people in the past. There's all these prints of indigenous people just like passively occupying space. And they're being framed by their own history, by all this archaeological ruins. But they don't know what to do with them, so they don't engage with them. So the white people are pointing at them, you know, and the Europeans are the ones explaining indigenous people their own past. So the científicos in the late 19th century is like, okay, we need to create an image of progress. We need to take back this idea that we don't know our own history. We need to also sediment that the same place where the capital of Mexico is was the same place where the Aztec capital was. So all this shit is happening, upholding indigeneity. But in the meantime, because of class, indigenous people van valiendo madre and nobody pays attention. And you have this dichotomy that it's embedded even to this day, even with a president that actually had indigenous presence in his opening. We still have those realities affecting Mexico, and not only Mexico, but different parts of Latin America.
Well, and the other.
Are you sure? Because
ahead. Go, 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 go ahead.
Bad joke.
No, go ahead. I'm not gonna block the joke.
I'm pretty sure La India Maria just like wiped it all clean, right?
She's like, I am going to undo all of this violence. That's so funny.
Well, and the other thing, the other thing that goes with that too, though, is sort of as that history is being played out, how, you know, there's also the project of liberalism.
Yeah.
And most people most people, when I say liberalism, I don't mean it like in the United States context. You know, if you look at Mexican liberalism, it was literally about foreign investment.
Right.
It was about the development of, you know, a modern, you know, sort of Mexico that was the project with everyone from, you know, with Juarez to Porfirio Díaz to
todos.
All of them. And so, you know, that's the other thing is sort of like, on the one hand, you're constructing this national identity that's really quintessentially Mexican, but to what end, right? Because on the other hand, you're developing this whole, you know, process of liberalism, which really is about the advancement of progress and the elite, you know?
And that was the discussion. I think Porfirio Díaz, I think there's speeches where it says, I'm sure that the key of the success of Mexico is indigenous people. We just don't know what to do with them. And we don't think we can actually educate them. So there were projects, Fabi, there were projects in the 19th century of mixing Europeans with indigenous people to para mejorar la raza. You know how we always talk about colorismo in Latin America?
Like, yeah, that was blancación. Actually,
yes, exactly, brancamiento. Like it was a form
of brancamiento,
an early form of brancamiento. Oof. I want to talk about, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that eugenics was all over, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole like pseudo-scientific, you know.
Limpieza de sangre.
Oh, all of it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's its own podcast.
that's a whole other. Yeah.
I feel like we're just starting, but I want to talk about a couple of other things, because when we talk, one of the things that I loved about the exhibition is to see paintings of María Izquierdo. I bet half of the people that understand and love and consume Frida don't even know who María Izquierdo is. So what is the legacy of Frida Kahlo and the presence of Frida Kahlo in her lifetime did to other women artists, other women, not only Mexican, but Latin American artists?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly she's overshadowed, you know, many of the women artists. At the time, though, María Izquierdo was... she was the top of her game, you know, like she was much better known artist than Frida was. In fact, you know, she was also going to be given the opportunity to create murals, but there was a pushback from the male artists. So I would argue even that even if, you know, yes, Frida has overshadowed people through her reputation, but at the time, women artists struggled just because of the nature of being women in a society where the male artists were elevated in the way that they were.
Right.
And so for María Izquierdo, I mean, I think I'm not sure how she, if she, you know, really, and she and Frida get grouped together a lot, because there were several artists, including herself and Frida and Soriano and Tamayo, who I guess exhibited in a show and that was called Surrealists.
Yes.
And so they kind of get grouped together as the sort of surrealist component of Mexican modernism. Mm-hmm. And I think each of them individually said, oh, we're not surrealists, you know, but at the same time, that's the way that they were being, you know,
grouped,
categorized and grouped. Mm-hmm. And so I think that both Frida and Maria probably felt like they were seen differently than the Tres Grandes.
Right.
So
and you mentioned that part of it was the whole thing with scaffolding and painting murals, right? That
the artists themselves actually said that, you know, in terms of María Izquierdo, she was going to have the opportunity to paint murals, and there was pushback from the male artists, and so she ultimately didn't end up getting to do it. So,
and like, that's the oldest conversation, like Artemisia Gentileschi in Italy in the 1600s, women were not allowed to paint ceiling programs because the fear that they will fall from scaffolding. Like they were not, if they were capable to paint the whole entire ceiling, they couldn't get on the scaffolding. So to protect them, you never saw ceiling programs painted by women. So it's the same discussion in the early 20th century.
And I mean, I haven't done the research, but I imagine that there are very, very few women fresco painters. And I don't know, I hadn't actually thought about that until now, but like, I don't know what the history of, you know, why women just generally are not considered, you know, fresco painters.
Because the patriarchy.
Yeah.
It's the patriarchy. It's the same reason why RuPaul never has another drag queen on the judges panel, like during his show, because right. he wants to be the only drag queen in power, right? And but, so to walk into a theater or a church and see a woman being the creator in front of an audience, that was too much. That was too much for the patriarchy, right?
Como dice mi suegra, quiere ser el ajonjolí de todos los moles.
Oh my gosh. I just found out what that word means.
Ajonjolí?
Isn't it sesame seeds?
Yes. Just in time, watching, girl.
I know. I've been watching Guatemalan YouTube cooking channels, and my people like to put ajonjolí in a lot of stuff.
That's an Arabic word, ajonjolí. It's Middle Eastern. But anyway.
Sorry.
And also, one of the things I like about María Izquierdo is that the oldest thing since 1493, that it's like the Americas, in this case Mexico, stays in the past. They have tradition, and Europe has science, right? They have technology. And that has been the conversation since the first letters of Christopher Columbus. Fast forward to the early 20th century, and André Breton comes to Mexico and is like, oh, Mexico is the surrealist country per excellence. Not because of the scientific approaches of the surrealists or deemed surrealist artists, but because their lives are too surreal to the European eye, right? And what I like about María Izquierdo is that she engages, like her portraits, her still lives are portraits. So it's all about the unconsciousness. It's all about this almost like psychological meaning that we give to objects. Like she engages with, quote unquote, the surrealism in a much more scientific way that was denied to like all female or to a certain degree to all Mexican, quote unquote, surrealist artists. And that's why I love María Izquierdo, because it reverses a little bit of the conversation of this whole thing that Mexico is so surrealist, that people live in Mexico and it's just so surreal, you know? And that's what happens with cinema. Like, speaking of Los Tres Grandes, those three movie directors, they're doing the same shit.
Oh, true, yeah.
Los, ¿cómo se llama?
Del Toro and...
Esos tres, like three dudes. Yeah, and they're engaging with presenting Mexico as a surrealist country. And that's what sells. And that's what brings people into Mexico. So just like the government, it's subsidizing all these muralist programs and also exploiting Mexico's fantasy to the rest of the world to invite progress, to invite industry, to invite tourists. The same thing is happening right now, but not through film. I think. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of work about that one movie that came out in the 1940s, The Three Caballeros, Los Tres Caballeros, that Disney did, touring Latin America, specifically Mexico, during the 40s. And the symbolism you see in that movie, it's just being chewed up, regurgitated, and put on TV over and over and over and over again. It's the same symbols. Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to talk about, it's one a way to reverse the conversation, not only surrounding freedom but modernism, which at the time, which in a way is at the core of this exhibition, it's how the Mexican modernists influenced U.S. artists. Very few people talk about that. So I wanted you to tell us a little bit more about that.
And that's really, you know, an area in, you know, the field of art history now that is just exploding in terms of the way that we're rethinking. Like, literally, you now have scholars saying this is the most important art movement to ever impact, you know, artists in the United States. As a new Mexican, I'm also very interested in thinking about how that connection to Mexico.
Right.
Because of our history with not only colonialism, but actually layers of colonialism, you know, we have kind of lost that connection to Mexico. And like, we were literally Mexico.
Yes.
And so when I'm thinking about my, you know, our museum and my role in our museum, like right now, not only do we have this Mexican modernism exhibition, but we also have an exhibition on a Posada, and then we also connect Luis Jimenez's works on paper, you know, to this broader conversation. And so, I think it's really, for me, reevaluating the way that we start to chip away at the mythology of the three races living together here in New Mexico,
right.
Chip away at, you know, the Hispanophile approach to thinking about the painful history that happened here. And so I think part of that is, you know, embracing our connection to Mexico. And so I think this is one way to do it. And certainly if you look at our collection here at the museum, for example, so many of those artists that came from all over the world to work here were also going to Mexico. And that was the time when they were being exposed to the Tres Grandes and, you know, all of the other components of it.
And didn't Siqueiros had a workshop in New York as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were traveling as well. Like, you know, there's the Orozco murals at Dartmouth, I think.
Yeah.
You know, they, and obviously Rivera has murals in, he was in San Francisco, Detroit, New York, you know.
Everywhere.
So they were everywhere. And there's, and then not only that, but think about printmaking, like the Taller de Gráfica Popular. You know, you have Elizabeth Catlett, who's going from United States to Mexico and becoming part of that printmaking collective. So there were huge exchanges. And I think also, if you look at the history and you think about, you know, during the periods of time when there were world wars, people couldn't travel to Europe necessarily. So where did they go? They went to Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cosmopolitan nature of Mexico City is something that I've always been fascinated by. Mm-hmm. And one of the elements of Mexican culture that as new Mexicans, we often overlook. But if you look at the history of Mexico City, it is literally, you know, the center of art and culture, certainly of the Western Hemisphere, always.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we forget. Mexico has been that since the 17th century. Mexico was in between Asia and Europe. So Asian and European goods had to be exchanged through Mexico. So Mexico has always been a crossroads when it comes to some of this cultural conversation, global cultural conversations for a long time. Every time I think about Mexican modernism and I think about Siqueiros, I always think of probably the most famous 20th century artist besides Norman Rockwell. It's Jackson Pollock.
Mm.
And everybody says, well, part of the reason why he has this huge scale paintings is because he was part of that workshop with Siqueiros. But also the Siqueiros push for experimentation to use sand in the paintings, to use other materials. So every time I see all this discussion about, like, malehood and how he dropped the cigarettes, I'm like, no, girl, he just learned from Siqueiros. You know, like, he just learned from a Mexican how to do some of these approaches.
Also, he was drunk.
Oh, also.
And he dropped a cigarette in the painting.
Over and over and over again. It's super fascinating. So, before we go, and this is something that the three of us can chip in. I feel like we can talk about it. So we talked about this legacy of Frida. We talked about the pearls behind indigeneity. We didn't even get to really talk about mestizaje, which is like its own monster, you know? But why do you think people not only identify so much, they get so defensive about Frida, but also, and I'm happy to say, she's also becoming this polarizing artist. Because we couldn't say this, like Fabi and I couldn't say this in the podcast 5 years ago. Like, some people hate Frida and some people love Frida. No, like everybody loves Frida. And now the conversation is switching, which reminds me, Fabi, I just read an article and I meant to send it to you about Selena. Now there's, I saw this article from a Texas newspaper that say, okay, let's be real. Like, we love Selena, but what would have happened if she stayed alive? And that's a conversation, for example, that we were having, like, a couple of, yes, shh, right? Bobby's like, I am not going to say anything. I did not.
Girl, I got some gigs in Texas that I don't want canceled, so.
But at least, what I'm trying to say here is that at least we're having this conversation. So now we can talk right. about Frida as a polarizing artist, not about Selena. We still all love Selena.
Anything for her.
Bless Selena. But so what is it about that? What is it about this extreme love for her, but now also like extreme rejection, which in a way I've pushed for.
For me, I guess that also one of the questions that I struggled with in kind of thinking about this exhibition was how everyone is so intensely engaged in sort of the personality of Frida, right? And her struggles and her heartbreaks and, you know, dealing with Diego. And so I've had so many interviews where, you know, the different interviewers were asking me about all like, oh, you know, do you think that she had this whatever?
Y que le puso el cuerno,
y guara, guara la cuchara. And so it sort of becomes this mythologized, again, kind of a cult of Frida. But as I showed you in the exhibition, there's some really incredible, like extremely political drawings that she did.
You have to see those. I'm going to send them to you.
During her time in New York, where she had a very, critical view of what she was seeing happening in the United States in terms of materialism and capitalism. So, you know, I wanted to get away from sort of, and even like the concept of death around Frida is another whole, you know, way that people engage with her. So I tried to focus a little bit more on thinking about resilience, you know, and she was dealing with so many of these things. And maybe that's the message that comes across in the end, like whether you love her or hate her, you know, there's a concept of resilience that's there as for all kinds of reasons. And so to me, when the conversation goes in that direction, it gets interesting. When it goes in the direction of sort of her, you know, her sensationalized, you know, love life and who she had affairs with. And like, that's the part that I think a lot of people get excited about, but it's not really, you know, the component that I think ultimately, if we're going to learn something from Frida, I think we have to go down a different path than sort of the sensationalized view of her, you know, love life and what we think her, you know, like, let's all speculate about her psychological state.
Right.
Like, that's the other thing that happens to artists all the time, that somehow we can psychoanalyze them through their artwork, you know. And so that's something also that I tried to really avoid doing in the process of thinking about the exhibition.
Yeah, and I mean, that also touches on like the perception of like male artists of the time and before, you know, like, I mean, I've heard here and there, like people talking about like Van Gogh and his mental illness, but it's never the topic of discussion.
No.
Right. It's like, it's always about it's the paintings and the romanticized version of their life. But with Frida, it cuts right to that trauma, right? And then right to the gossip and how did she get there? You know, oh, well, she slept with this person and that person, right? And I'm like, I'm sorry, but you don't think these male painters were also doing the same thing even worse than her, right?
Yeah.
But there was, you know, even back then, the bro code, right? Nobody said anything.
Well, and so, I don't know, going back to your movie, you know, the mentioning of the film, you know, that I don't know if that's also what like exploded that whole, you know, biographical approach to thinking about her.
Yeah, I definitely think, I mean, that was one of the first times that I ever saw Frida depicted. So a lot of my ideas behind her came from that depiction, much like tying it back to Selena, much like, you know, especially Gen Z right now, they don't remember Selena. They only know Selena from the movie.
The movie.
And that's who they love, J-Lo playing Selena. And so I feel like a lot of these people that are big Frida fans are really Salma Hayek fans. and that's interesting to me, right? It's like, again, reshaping. It's like a reshaping of these national symbols for white audiences in the United States. 'Cause that movie wasn't for Mexicans.
Right. And there were other bad. No, there were some really interesting movies about Frida. But no, I think you're all right, because that's always been the conversation about women artists. Again, I go back to Artemisia Gentileschi, and the whole conversation around her was about the trials about her sexual abuse. And it's we're so fascinated to read every single painting as a revenge to what happened to her. But when you start looking at the way that she manipulates the iconography that has been done the same for hundreds of years, and how she flips it because she was amazing, not because of what might have happened, not because of her trauma, we start rethinking her legacy, her art, and her career as the career of an artist, not the career of a female artist. Mm-hmm. Which is something that, again, nos encanta el chisme, nos encanta el chisme. So we're always relating not only to female artists but also to queer artists in relationship to those, to some of those ideas.
Yeah, and I think you know, you and I have talked a little bit about even like if you have a person of color who paints a landscape. You know, all of a sudden, because if they're African American, it's about the Civil War, you know, or whatever, whatever happened, whatever your own identity is, somehow you have to represent that identity.
Right. Or the fantasies that other other people have with that identity, precisely.
Yeah. But, and I think that goes back to what you were saying earlier, Justin, about sort of like, how did Frida then become the quintessential representation of Mexico?
Right.
Yeah, and I think back to Frida being polarizing and what we think about that and how and why she's a polarizing artist. A lot of people put that on Frida, like she's the one telling her story over and over again, right? It's not I don't know. I don't think I can ever say that I hate Frida. I hate the way that people tell her story, right? And I think that's what I'm paying attention to. I like to listen to a lot of podcasts, and I think out of all the podcasts listed on iTunes, when you search Frida Kahlo, I think maybe one is talking about Frida in a critical, historical way. The rest of them are talking about her love life or her relationship with Diego, right?
Pues, sí.
And so I think that right now what's happening is that people are, I think people that have been telling Frida's story in that way are coming to terms with the fact that they're being agents of this like false narrative, and starting to actually listen to the alternative ones, because for so long they had this idea of her in their heart, and it became such a personal story because that's exactly what it was. It was a story that they made up to fit whatever narrative they needed it to heal in themselves. And they're using Frida
projecting
as that. They're projecting all of their shit onto Frida, which I think, I mean, I know I was doing that, right? And so, I think talking about Frida with people really reveals more about the person and their knowledge or understanding of art history than who Frida actually was.
And to me, the biggest pearl is, not pearl, peril.
Peril.
With Frida, it's that I can never divorce her from a much longer visual culture of fantasies about Mexico. And because the fantasy of wild changos and all this Mexico, once again, it dates back to the letters of Columbus. I mean, he didn't arrive to Mexico, but the way that the Cortes of Mexico, and that it was built and constructed in the European imaginary. So I see her as part of that visual culture. However, I also think that we still need exhibitions about Frida, right? We still need to see her art, and we still need to be critical, because some of these conversations about our own fantasies about Mexico, which again, they get filtered, as you say, Fabi, through Frida. Some are our own fantasies about indigeneity. Some of our own fantasies about mestizaje. And I'm not just saying like white people have these fantasies. We all do, right? And we all have different relationships with Latin America. In a way, those conversations could start by the most recognizable image of Mexico or even Latin America, and that is Frida Kahlo. So for that reason and the contextualization of her legacy and Diego's legacy through modernism, this is the best show. It's amazing. I love that you inherited a show and you transform it into something a lot more critical. Fabi, if you had a chance before it goes, like it's so, I'm going to send you a bunch of pictures.
How long is the exhibition up?
May 2nd. So it's open through May 2nd here in Albuquerque. And then a lot of the works in the exhibition are actually part of the Mexican National Patrimony. So they're going to have to go back to Mexico very quickly after the show ends here in the United States. And that's a whole other conversation too, is sort of like how the Gelman collection came together. We also had to collaborate with INBAL, which is the national, cultural institution of Mexico, because a lot of these works were national patrimony. So yeah, it's really a privilege, you know, to have, the conversation in the building, whether again, as a curator, my approach to thinking about these things is that, you know, if someone comes to an exhibit and they love it or they hate it, if they feel something, then
that's it.
Then we're doing something right. Yeah. And so, I hope all the folks who both love and hate Frida, you know, will take the opportunity to sort of find some of the gems that are in there. Like you and I talked a little bit about the Tamayo painting of Cantinflas.
It's so good.
And just this sort of dark representation of, you know, this very comic figure.
Yeah.
So there's so many, you know, wonderful works that are in the exhibition and a lot of ways to engage with a whole lot of conversations around certainly Mexico and New Mexico's connection to Mexico.
Yeah, which that's a whole nother conversation. By the way, one of the things that Josie's doing is reinstalling some of the main exhibitions that have always been around. And when I finish the quick tour that Josie just gave me, I told her, I said, I am not from Albuquerque anymore, but this is the first time that I feel proud of this museum. It makes sense. There's a lot of voices that were erased for a long time, and now they're part of the conversation. The labels are in both Spanish and English. In the only state where there's two official languages in New Mexico, Spanish and English. That wasn't part of it, right? So like all these things that make so much sense that you forget that they were not part of this exhibition for a long time. So as a former Burgueño, like I thank you so much because I think your work is amazing. And I'm excited for what's to come, not only for the museum, but also for you, which, by the way, what's next?
Yeah, we have so many well, as I was saying to you earlier, you know, we probably bring about, there are about 8 changing exhibitions in the museum every year. And so it's just constant projects. We've been talking with Denver Art Museum about an exhibition on La Malinche.
Woo-hoo.
There are quite a few other, but we take it seriously that not many New Mexicans maybe aren't going to have the opportunity to travel, you know, to see exhibitions in different parts of the world. So we're doing a design exhibition on an artist named Rennie McIntosh, you know, who not all people are going to relate to because it's a very European, you know, design, look at design, but that's important too.
Right.
Like we feel like our, you know, we're not trying to promote one specific idea and, you know, like it's a really corny kind of mission statement, but it's like, you know, we bring Albuquerque to the world and the world to Albuquerque but we mean it, you know, like we actually mean it. Like we really want to bring as many diverse experiences as we can. And thank you for your kind words, but I'll just sort of give a shout out to our museum team as well, because we have, you know, our director and assistant director, our staff, our education team, you know, we all work together really hard. And I think we're in a moment right now where, you know, there is a willingness to talk about being a bilingual. Like, what does it mean to have bilingual labels?
What a concept.
Yeah. So, you know, there that willingness of our staff to be able to participate in that conversation is pretty amazing. And we're in a time when museums are sort of under some scrutiny, right? For all kinds of reasons. And yeah. And some reasons good, you know, in some ways we have to rethink, like, what is the purpose of our public institution? What audiences are we serving? And so I think, you know, that's another reason why, you know, a Frida exhibition is so important, because it allows us to raise a lot of those questions, even within the context of something that's very much, you know, museum friendly.
Right, right, right.
So anyhow, but yeah, so that's sort of what's next. Lots of diverse exhibitions, continuing to grow our collections, and hopefully engaging with other museums, you know, in making sure that we're sharing our collections also broadly to other projects.
Anything
amazing? Yes. Shout out to you and everybody at the Albuquerque Museum. I'm going to try to make it now that I'm vaccinated and I have some time on my hands. Maybe I'll make the drive, because it sounds amazing. And if you're listening to this and you're in Albuquerque, you guys got some amazing paintings right there in your city that are not going to be there for very long. And some of them will probably be put away for a long time after right. this. So mm-hmm. check them out. Yeah,
definitely. So before we go, where can we find you? Is there any, I know you work in other exhibitions, any publications that you've done that you want to recommend for our audiences before we go, your social media handles, todas esas cosas.
Well, I think, you know, you can find me here at the museum. So definitely Albuquerque Museum. I did work on a project in 2017 on an exhibition that I really loved. It was called The Carved Line, Block Printmaking in New Mexico. And so that was published by Museums of New Mexico Press, and that's available. One of my favorite projects, and I was really lucky to kind of get my feet wet in terms of museum work through that project. So that was fantastic. But mostly you'll find me here working away on lots of exhibitions, you know, and so come check us out. This podcast will be part of one of our Third Thursday events. Mm-hmm. And so we have free, you know, events every Third Thursday since COVID. It's gone virtual. But once we're able to have in-person events again, those kinds of programs will be back in the museum. And I can't wait to be able to, like, have talks with people in the building. And
what a concept,
you know. So you know, a lot of people forget that we're sort of like in their backyard, you know, so they don't really think of us as having constantly new exhibitions and new programs, but we do. And it's an amazing amount of work that our staff puts into it.
Amazing stuff, amazing programming. Josie, thank you so much for this. I think, yeah, por lo menos, yeah. I feel like this was a chapter that we had to close, you know, like another conversation with Frida, but now with somebody that has been hands-on with her work for a while now, and you've been studying this for a long time. So thank you so much for allowing for this conversation.
Thank you, and I'm sorry that this is the last Latinos Who Lunch, but
it's all right.
We can have a cheers to.
Oh shit! I don't have anything to drink. A cup of highlighters. Hey. No, I mean this is the sunset of Latinos Who Lunch, but who knows? Maybe we'll do some fun stuff. Very, very special episodes in the future. But yeah, thank you once again. And Babelito, thank you for connecting with Josie and making this amazing podcast happen. This is so cool to actually be talking to curators and art historians. And this is exactly what this podcast is about, right? And so we are so grateful to be having these really cool and important conversations. Anything else, Babs?
That's it.
All right. As always, you can visit us at latinoswholunch.com. If you can, please leave us a review, 5 stars.
5 estrellas solamente.
because the more reviews we have, the more visible we are. And
visibility leads to representation, and representation matters.
Today's episode was produced by Justin Favela and Emmanuel Ortega, with production assistance from Maite Sosa. The music you're listening to right now is by the band Balloon. We'll put that in post. I'm Fabi Fab.
And this is Babelito.
Bye.
Ciao, ciao, ciao.
Say bye, Josie.
Bye.